Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Diana Leon Boys. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of South Florida.
Prof. Diana. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'd like to start by asking, what are the things or the thing currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for the invitation, first of all, and also for really helping me get my mind going this morning, thinking about that. There's a lot on my mind, but I think that one of the main, like the nucleus of so many things going around at once is it's kind of at the intersection of my personal life and also the work that I do, my research, because maybe coincidentally, maybe not coincidentally, a lot of the work that I do in girls' media studies has been inspired by my own personal experience as the mother of two young daughters, though previously it was just one young daughter. I actually just had a child. I had my second daughter in June of this past year, and
Congratulations.
I'm thank you so much. And it had been a decade since I had my first daughter, so it is very interesting to think about the work that I do and the research that I do on Latina girlhood and how a lot of the questions that I previously had when I started doing this work about a decade ago have changed or morphed or taken on a new meaning even now as I embark on, my motherhood journey 2.0 with another girl. And really the types of conversations and questions that's bringing up inside me as I not only rethink my work, but also think about what are the next stages? What is the next phase of the research that I'm going to do? This is my first book just came out a year ago, and it's one of those, it's kind of a scary moment sometimes to think, all right, what comes after that first book? What is it? Am I going to more or less keep going down a similar path and exploring similar research questions, continuing to extend those, or shifting gears and paying attention to other things that I had previously wanted to interrogate or look at before that? So a lot of that is on my mind as I also try being the operative word here, really figure out that balance between being a researcher, being a professor, and also being a mother to two young girls, in a very specific time period when there's a lot going on in our world, politically, particularly, and especially in this country, that really deeply affects young girls and girlhood in general. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking about that are, exciting me and at the same time making me pause and
I
have
think light euphemism is challenging me,
there we go,
right?
there we go, challenging. Yeah, and all of that is on my mind right now as I am sort of in a full circle moment because I am currently in Austin, Texas. I am giving a book talk tonight at my alma mater, Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas, and it's a very bizarre and beautiful feeling because at that institution is where so many of these questions and seeds were planted. And at that institution is where I thought, can I be a professor? Can I continue down this path? And can I pursue this, this really what seemed to me at the time to be this really cool and exciting journey, which it has been. And it's really great to come kind of back here to be full circle giving this talk in a room where I watched so many speakers come and share their work years ago, and now I'll be doing the same and talking about some of these questions that preoccupy me and challenge me and really get that light bulb sparking and going on and off all the time. So yeah, that's just a little bit about that. So hopefully we can talk maybe a little bit more about those components, however you see fit.
Beautiful. I mean, I'd like to go on to focus on Elena, Princess of the Periphery, but before we do that, I wonder if I could pick up on the child, daughter, motherhood issue and ask you what you think are some of the similarities and the differences in terms of Latina girls and their experiences of the media when you were growing up, for your 10-year-old and for your newborn.
Yes, absolutely. That is such a great question. And it's something that I talk to. It's so fun now because I actually can talk about these things with my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, who's actually not the 8-month-old. She's actually going to be 11 next week, a week from today. And it's so great that I can talk about a lot of these things with her now, whereas previously when I had just started doing this work, it was not the same conversations that we're having now. But one of the things that I always tell her and stress is that, even though you do hear mom talking about all of these different ways in which I wish these representations were better, or I wish that Disney could do X, Y, and Z differently, it's really cool. I tell her that you can turn on the TV or go to the movies even, and at least find maybe one or two little slivers of representation that align with who you are and how you understand yourself in the world. Particularly thinking about, hey, I see Latina girls on the screen. Because I tell her when I was a child, I had none of that, right? I was born in Mexico City, but I moved to the US when I was two. So I grew up, I spent my whole life, my childhood in Texas, and I consumed a lot of popular culture. In the early 90s, I was consuming a lot of popular culture, and really it was striking that I never really found any characters or any storylines that really resonated with my experience, or any person in popular culture that I would think, oh, that's really cool. Like, that speaks to who I am and how I understand myself in the world. And in particular, this is something I talk about briefly in the introduction of my book. It was when you're thinking about play culture and pretend, it was especially challenging for me because, I dressed up a lot, not just for Halloween, but also for different school events. And I never really was able to find that character or that princess person, whatever it was that I felt like I could actually embody and become through play. And not that you have to, of course, find, somebody that aligns perfectly with your race or ethnicity or what have you, but it was something that I did think about as a child. Like, who can I be? Like, what costume can I buy that will, that I'll feel comfortable in, that I feel like sort of represents who I am. And I think a lot of that, it didn't necessarily come from inside me. It actually came from conversations that I had with other peers who would say, oh, well, you can't be this character, or you can't be this Power Ranger because you're not white or whatever, which for me back then was so striking because I thought, like, phenotypically, I thought, no, I am white. Like, yes, like, look at my skin color. But I think that it was much deeper than that, right? It went beyond just the color of the skin to, the language that I spoke and who my parents were and the fact that, they didn't speak English. So I think then I just kind of became like an outsider in that setting. And it was hard for me through pretend and play to find characters that I thought I could embody through putting on the clothes or whatever. And then, fast forward, I have an almost 11-year-old who, although representations are quite limited, they're more than what I had, of course, as a child. When Elena of Avalor, the television series came out, she was young. She was at the age where the princess culture and the cartoons were very relevant and exciting. And for her, it was really cool. And in a way that she didn't realize just how much it actually meant. Like, oh yes, there's this Latina princess or Latina. I say that in quotes because it, the findings in my book actually indicate that she's not a Latina, but that's another topic. And for her, it's exciting, right, to see this. And but it's exciting and not really that big of a deal because that's kind of although there aren't many representations, that's kind of what she's been used to in this like subtle and ambiguous kind of way when she sees television. And then for the decade later, for the newborn, I think that what we're seeing more and more of now are representations that are less ambiguous, that are less sort of, you know, blurry in terms of what this character is, where they're from, what their background is. We have a little bit more specificity when it comes to the representations. However, still a very small amount that does not match up to the actual number of Latinxes that are living in the US. So yes, I've seen the what some people would call a boom, particularly when it comes to the terrain of girlhood, because a lot of the representations that we're seeing more and more of in terms of Latinidad and Latinas are in the terrain of girlhood, which is something that I can also talk about in terms of what I think is happening there. But it's still not, the numbers are still not, they don't match with the demographics in this nation, particularly when it comes to the trends that we're seeing and the predictions of what the numbers will look like for Latinxes under the age of 18 post like 2040 or, you know, 2045, all of those census numbers and the predictions. So although we are seeing more and more, and I'm very grateful for that, and I appreciate the fact that, you know, now my daughters can look on the screen and at least find two or three characters or costumes or whatever that represent their identities, there's still a long way to go. And I do want to always keep in mind that popular culture, and I always say this in my talks and my spiels and my lectures or whatever, popular culture is significant, particularly when we are talking about children and the way that children come to understand who they are in the world, how they come to understand how others know them and their place in the world. And I think that it's very often brushed off and just kind of brushed aside. And it's not something that we should just take as lightly as we sometimes do, because like I said, again, I'll reiterate it one more time, particularly for children at the stage, especially when they're consuming cartoons, right? At that age, when they are making sense of the world and really making all of these deep connections, these representations matter. These representations are very important. And it's, as you can see, as you can hear from what I've said now, it's things that you carry on into your adult life in terms of how you understand your place and your place in the nation and whether or not you belong and how you belong in these spaces. So a lot of that for me was, it kind of came to be in those early years, and a lot of it centered around popular culture and how I understood who I was based on what I was seeing in pop culture.
And of course, one of the problems here is that the attempts to shift Hollywood studios and cultural production in general in the US in the interests of a broader African-American representation has worked at the level of both text and occupation. It hasn't changed anything with reference to Latinas and Latinos, who are, you know, a bigger, slightly bigger percentage of the US population than African-Americans are. And of course, there is an overlap between African-Americans and Latinas and Latinos, but are nowhere near the level of representation in leading roles or in so-called creative roles, screenwriters, directors, and so on. So you guys can sometimes be targets, in inverted commas, but the question is where the reins of control lie. I found documents dating back to the late 60s in which advertising agencies are going through the same dilemma that Hollywood and the TV networks claim to go through today. How do we cope with them? Some of them want it to be in Spanish. Some of them want it to be in English. Same dilemmas, same nonsense. Prof, one of the things that you come up with in this terrific book, Elena, and let's get onto that in a full-throated way now, is what you call for is an architecture of flexibility, something that you see Disney as managing to have, in a certain sense, not necessarily in the way that you might wish. Could you tell us what the architecture of flexibility idea is, and a little bit about the text of Elena and its positive, negative, in-between features.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is what you're referring to, that continuum of flexibility, the architecture of flexibility is actually, it's in the, so my book is divided into what I call like the different case studies. I look at the production, which is the first case study. The second case study is the text, the actual episodes of the television series, and then the third case study is the audience portion, where I did my ethnographic work at both of the U.S. theme park locations, both of the Disney theme park locations, the one in Anaheim and then the one in Orlando. So for the architectural flexibility, this is in the text chapter. So this is in the second case study, and this is actually the chapter that I struggled with the most. I had the most experience in doing textual analyses. This is something that I was, you know, I felt confident in doing, and I had done for a long time throughout my undergraduate career, my master's program, my doctoral program. And I thought, yes, textual analysis, I can do them left and right all the time. But what I kept struggling with in that, it, you know, the writing process and the draft after draft after draft, is that I kept falling back on, this is, you know, let me go back up a little bit and say that I did an analysis of all 70, how many? 74, 75, 70 something episodes of the series. And I kept coming back to, this is a stereotypical representation. This is not, this is a stereotypical representation. This is not. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is so boring. It is so black and white. Like what I'm seeing on the screen is not so binary. I need to develop a different way for talking about what I'm seeing, for talking about the tropes that I'm seeing, the images, and the repeat of so many different things. And I cannot just go back to, this is a stereotype and this is not. So I decided that it would be productive to, because I found that there was a lot of in between. There was a lot of ground in the middle between this binary of it's stereotypical, it's not. And at the end of the day, spoiler alert, I do want to say that most of it does fall in line with continuity. Is most of it is pretty stereotypical, because that's the template that media and Disney in particular have, and they know that the template works. They know that it sells. They know that it generates audiences. So the times when they do sort of stray away from this template, it's rare. But what I decided to do was develop sort of like a layered way of looking at these representations. I thought, I want to be able to say something much more layered and complex than this is a stereotype or this is not a stereotype. So I, because the title of my book is about flexibility, I argue that this princess and the narrative is very flexible in nature, and how Disney molds her to adapt to different cultural needs and the needs of the audiences. So I created a continuum to address that type of flexibility that I found throughout the narrative. So on one end of the spectrum, I have a weightless flexibility, which is basically what you would think of for the more stereotypical types of representations, right? Do you see a Latina dancing, the Spitfire, the Bandido, the Latin Lover, right? That would be more of like the weightless flexibility. Then on the other end of the spectrum, I have what I call transformational flexibility, which is those rare moments where I think that, you know, you really do see those little slivers of hope in media representations, particularly pop culture representations. One of the ones that I use as an example here is the Jewish Latina princess. And this is something that, and I actually had a really great and productive conversation with my daughter about this back when the episode came out. She was much younger. I believe at this point she was 6 or 7. She was a child, and she literally stopped and said, oh yes, Jewish Latinas. They do exist, but you don't really see them on TV. And I thought, okay, so this is one of those moments that's more layered. It has different representational flexibilities. are different representational possibilities, not flexibilities. But they're rare, right? These moments of transformational flexibility that I have on the very end of this continuum are those that I say they're rare, and they're little snippets and they're flashpoints, but they are the ones that I'm hopeful that we can continue to see more of as the years go by, right? As these higher ups realize, okay, these stories that we're selling maybe really do need to have more layers and more substance to them. But going back to the continuum, in between those two ends of the spectrum, I do have an ambiguous flexibility and a hybrid flexibility, all different types of flexibilities that I use to sort of outline what I'm seeing in the television series. So, like, for example, with hybrid flexibility, you know, I argue that that's where you see mixtures of a lot of specific markers. So an episode or a scene, even in an episode that would fall within hybrid flexibility, might have different signifiers that pertain to different types of Latinidades, which can be identified by members of the group, but are still like really messy. So like the Latinidades are named, but often like used together in ways that don't really make sense. So in this fantastical land, you know, you would see, for example, like different references to like different locations, but all within the same place. So something that you know is in Peru and something else that you know is in Mexico, for example, put together as if they coexist in the same place, right? So it's still messy, but it has that layer or that element of specificity. So one of the things about this continuum of flexibility that I was really hopeful for, and that I continue to be very hopeful for, is that other scholars who are looking at media representations, particularly of underrepresented groups, and that could be anything from like differently abled people to, you know, the representation of Muslim girls on TV, whatever it is, I'm hopeful that this can be adapted and this can be used in that setting. And I actually already have two. And I don't know, maybe if they're just because they're my doctoral students, but I already have two students that are implementing it or a version of it into their work and into the research projects. And I cannot remember exactly what it is, but I do know that one of them who's looking at Muslim girlhood is actually adding another little category before transformational flexibility. I can't tell you off the top of my head what that one is, but she's using it to account for like the space of in-betweenness between those last two. And that is what I was most hopeful for. I thought this can be applied outside of Latinidad and outside of looking at Latina girlhood. And it's a way, at least in my, you know, in my research, to account for the moments that are in between the really stereotypical representations that, my goodness, how many more Dia de los Muertos can we see? You know, how many more quinceañeras? My goodness, all right, we got it. It sells. It's a formula. Okay, let's move on. The moments in between that are not necessarily, wow, like, you know, shattering in any way. And for the purposes of, you know, of this television series, like I said briefly, when I started answering this question, I there are more continuities than there are ruptures. There are very, very few instances of transformational flexibility, but there is transformational flexibility right there. I see transformational flexibility very deeply in one of the characters, the character of Elena's sister. Her name is Isabel. She's an inventor. She falls in line with a lot of the STEM girl genius tropes that I've written about, but it is layered in a way that is unique and is a little bit different than what I had previously seen. But overall, when you're looking at not only the 70 plus episodes of the series, but also the corporate social responsibility reports and the presence of this character at the theme park spaces, there are far more continuities. And there are far more elements of that weightless and ambiguous flexibility within the entirety of Elena of Avalor than there are moments of transformational flexibility. But, you know, definitely 20 steps forward from something like Saludos Amigos, for example, or Los Tres Caballeros. So at least in that sense, you know, it's refreshing in a way.
Prof, I'm going to turn off my camera for a moment while I manage the podcat, who's proving difficult. And I don't want to disrupt you while I deal with him, which is to say, love him. But while I do so, I wondered if, because my mic will still be open, of course, if you could ponder this for me, and it relates to something you just said. One of the issues you raise in the study of the theme parks is Disney's uncertainty about how to present and manage, to use that word again, Elena. And some of this relates to COVID-19 and the problems that theme parks experienced and probably still do in their recovery, in inverted commas. But I wondered if you could share with us a little bit of that research, that finding, what you experienced.
Absolutely. And you want me to wait, right, until you come back?
No, please. I'm still listening.
Oh, I see.
I'm just going to be invisible to you so you don't see me as I pick him up, cuddle him, and hope not to get bitten or scratched.
Oh, goodness. No, I'll just imagine that as I talk through this. it's a good visual. No, I love this. I really love talking about this because this is something that I'm still trying to make sense of and hoping. And oh, my goodness, I keep saying that I'm hoping to do more work on this. And honestly, I've been saying this for far too long. And I'm like, all right, come on, this has to happen. I really, there's so much follow-up work that I want to continue doing. But I want to go back to the first part of it. Yes, I do think that what I was able to find through my work is that it is messy, so messy, as you can tell from the findings. And Disney, but it's not just Disney. This is media, like we're talking about, you know, pop culture at large, messy in the sense that they are still really trying to figure out what the heck to do with Latinidad, right? And it makes sense because we are just so different and so layered. And there is just so either, you know, there's not one size fits all. There's not one equation, right? So we have media at large that I believe are still trying to make sense of what to do and how to represent this heterogeneity within Latinidad. And what we see happening at the theme parks and what we see happening with Disney is that this cultural product, the way that I refer, that's how I refer to Elena of Avalor, particularly at the theme park space, right? How Disney is moving this cultural product around and how Disney is manipulating and stretching, you know, to use the rubber band metaphor again, this really flexible character narrative and storyline at their theme park spaces. And so much of that is specific. It really has to do with the geography, like parks, where they are located, what that means in terms of not just the tourists that are coming to the park, not just the demographics that they're attracting internationally, but also nationally. And this is data that Disney has. Like Disney knows, you know, who's coming to the parks. Are the people that are going to Anaheim coming from, you know, primarily X, Y, and Z location? Are the people that are going to Orlando coming mostly from these countries, coming at this? And it's also very seasonal, right? Who is coming from what part of the world at what season? And, you know, what are they looking for? What do they want? And this is a lot of data that that the parks have been gathering for quite a while. And like I said, it also is dependent on not just the international flows that we're seeing at the parks, but also the national people that are coming into the park. So when I did the first part of the ethnography that I did was at Anaheim. So I traveled to California in the summer of 2018. And then 11 months later, summer of 2019 was when I did my work in Orlando. And I actually did not live in Florida at that point. I was still at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. So I was not, a Florida resident.
Urbana-Champaign, the geographical and climatic paradise of the Midwest.
Exactly, which honestly I really miss. So I really miss that. I miss the snow. I miss the I wouldn't I never thought I would say I miss the cornfields. I miss the cornfields. So that's
Well,
another
also,
story.
it is an intellectual powerhouse as a.
Oh, yes, it's such a unique intellectually stimulating environment that I miss dearly every single
I
day.
get it.
But
Anyway, I'm sorry to have interrupted. So you went to the different kind of wasteland that is Anaheim.
Yes, exactly. So when I was actually more familiar with Anaheim, with that theme park than I was with
Sure.
Florida.
Or
I hadn't
Orlando,
I
yeah.
have family in I have family in Tijuana and San Diego, and I would visit them a lot. So we do trips to the parks and all of that. But Florida, I hadn't been to Florida since I was like, I think 11 years old. So I went back to do the research after not having been to Florida in so long. And even initially, as you step into the park, it's a very different experience that you have with the people that are with the audience, to use Disney terminology, with the guests, with the Disney park guests. The accents that you hear, right? A lot of people coming from the South, even the international populations, the Spanish speakers that I would interact with, or the Spanish speakers that I would hear, were not the same types of Spanish speakers that you get a lot of in Anaheim because of the location, the proximity to the US-Mexico border, right? And the population of Mexicans in that particular area is much higher, of course, than it is in Orlando or in the surrounding area. So very, very different groups of people that you have in both of these spaces. And you already know the findings from this section of the book. But what I saw, I shouldn't say the theme park, what I saw that Disney was doing at both of the locations was it was just drastically different, the way that these characters were being put forth to interact with park guests and the scripts. And I will say scripts because these are scripts. I know that they are scripts. I have since had also a few conversations with people who are cast members currently and previously at the theme parks. These have not been formal like research conversations. This is just so happened to be because of the fact that I live in Florida now. And there are a lot of people there that at least there's people at USF that I've taught who are former cast members. And then also my daughter just so happens to have a friend whose mother and a lot of her family, they work at the parks. So I know for a fact, all of that to say that they have scripts. And of course, it's Disney. Of course, they're going to have scripts. The scripts that they give to these actresses slash cast members are very, very different in Florida versus Anaheim. And just a quick rundown of the findings. And I think the biggest piece of the findings is that in California, the cast members whom I saw play the part of Elena on over the 2 day period that I was there on the ground were, and this could be because of the location, right? The proximity to the US-Mexico border. They spoke in Spanish quite openly, quite often. So if you had a child or an adult or whoever, like I would go up to the princesses themselves and I would say, ¿Cómo estás? Buenos días. Hablan español. Just completely communicate with them in Spanish, and they would talk back in Spanish to me. It was a very Mexican Spanish, and I know how to pick up on this because of the fact that I'm from Mexico. So, certain words that were used or phrases, it was actually. Sometimes when this is the kind of vocabulary that you use, you don't really realize it or recognize it. These two women would often say, "Qué padre," and I say that all the time. And I remember when I was, breaking down a lot of these things with my advisor at Illinois, Dr. Angela Valdivia. She's from Chile, and she's like, "Why do you all say that? Like, what?" She's like, "Qué padre," and I'm like, "Oh yeah, that just means like how cool, like." That's so neat or whatever. And it wasn't until I actually sat down and broke down a lot of these phrases that the princesses were using, the cast members, I was, it was very obvious that this was very it was very specific to like Mexico terminology, slang, etc. But the most striking part to me is not those specific parts of of the slang. It was more so that there was Spanish, and that Spanish was allowed to occupy a space at the Anaheim theme park, where 11 months later, when I was at the Orlando location, I noticed this through my own conversations and my daughter's conversations with the, I saw a lot of people playing the role. I want to say it was like maybe five, or I can't remember the exact number. I think I saw five different cast members play the part of Elena. They were not allowed. And I will say allowed, because I think that this is a very strategic decision that the conglomerate made. They were not allowed to speak Spanish. So they had very similar lines that they would utter to anybody who would ask them to speak Spanish, myself included, my daughter included, and plenty of other people that I heard ask her, or just not even ask her, ¿hablas español? But also start conversations in Spanish. The different women who were playing the part, the different cast members, would always say something to the effect of, yes, I do speak Spanish, but I'm practicing my English. I'm in Cinderella's kingdom, and my grandmother told me that I should speak English here. And I mean, just think about the wording of that, you know, so similar to other things that we've heard, and particularly other things that unfortunately politicians have uttered in the past, of the place and space of Spanish in this country. And those lines were uttered time and time and time again. And this is one of the reasons why I keep saying that I really want to do at least a little bit more follow-up work, because of the fact that I know that in Orlando, the princess still occupies that prominent place that she occupied when I went to do my work in 2019. And I am very curious to, you know, because all of this is flexible, right? We can easily move these characters. We can change their scripts. I don't say we, I'm not part of Disney. They can easily change the scripts and where they're placed and all of this stuff. It's very dynamic. And I would love to see how this continues to play out at the parks to this day. Because when I was there, it was very obvious that they were scripted, that these characters were scripted to not speak Spanish and to not communicate with park guests in Spanish. Very particular time periods, right? Where we are, you know, at this point, Donald Trump was president. We had so much specific rhetoric, not only about Latinxes, a lot of times Mexicans in particular, and Spanish. And we heard this on the campaign trail quite a bit, Spanish, and not communicating in Spanish, and what that meant, and why in the U.S. this is a place where you speak English, and so on and so forth. Conversations and you know, things that I'm sure that you can recall, and unfortunately others can recall as well. But I saw so much of that happening at the park, and it was something that I was completely took me by surprise. You know, a lot of the things that I find in terms of the femininity and like the actual gestures and the ways that this princess carried herself in relation to girls, I wasn't too surprised by that. But it was more so the language and the Spanish and the place and space that occupied at both of the theme parks, and how drastically different it was at each one of the locations. And like you said previously, you know, so much is changing there at the parks. COVID had a huge effect on, you know, the revenue loss for the parks and what is it called? What is the sector? Parks and experiences. You know, Disney has been vocal about it through their annual reports and the reports that they put forth for their investors and the stakeholders and all of that. But, you know, there's many ways in which they are trying to adapt and figure out how to make up for all of that lost revenue. I mean, the Florida park wasn't closed for very long, actually, which, you know, makes sense because nobody in Florida believed in COVID anyway. But in California, that park was closed for very well over a year. And I can't even imagine what that looks like in terms of revenue loss. But yes, I think that it's something that the parks, not just in particular, not just specific to Elena, but it's something that I think the Disney Corporation is still trying to make sense of. How do they place Latinidad in the parks? Where and how and to what extent? And sometimes it's seasonal too when it comes to other characters. And the last thing that I'll say about this is that I was very, very much looking forward to taking a research trip to Euro Disney to do a more transnational study. And it's just the way it happened is just so funny and sad at the same time, because I was looking forward to taking this trip in April of 2020 to round out that that national work that I had done. And I really wanted to make sure that that was part of the book, that that was the other layer to the ethnographic component of the book. And then, of course, joke was on me, and definitely didn't happen in April. And I thought, oh, back then I thought maybe I'll be able to take the trip in the summer of 2020, like when everything is when everything is different and we're all back to non-COVID or whatever. But yeah, that never happened. And then, the tenure clock and the book and all of that stuff, I thought, you know what, I'm gonna get the book out with just the US theme park analysis. And then perhaps after the book comes out, I will look into maybe extending that further and doing a more transnational, more of a global look at things, because I am so curious to see what those conversations look like. Because at least back in 2018 and 2019, and even very early in 2020, the presence of this princess in Euro Disney was very prominent. But a lot of what I was hearing around the inclusion of the princess and how park guests were experiencing her was that she was La Princesa Española. She was the Spanish princess. So, a lot of that also comes with audiences and in the terrain of audience studies and how people are attaching meaning to a character, to a storyline, to a narrative based on who they are. And I think that that also speaks a lot to the flexibility that I find within the series, a flexibility that can be both beautiful and welcome because it attracts and can speak out to so many people. But it's also really messy and it leaves us wanting more.
Prof DLB, if I may, I have two more questions for you, and then I'd like to
Absolutely.
throw it to you to add anything you might wish to what we've already said. Sound okay?
Perfect.
And thank you for tolerating my little interlude with the pussycat.
Oh,
So,
it was lovely. I'm glad I got to see a little bit of it.
so the first one actually follows on what you were just telling us, and it's to ask you two things about the parks. One, from your book, whether you could explain whether you have an idea of why there were these different language policies in Anaheim compared to Orlando. And the second is to take you away from the book and into your the second part of the last two questions, into your work on Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, which was a co-authored article. So I wondered if you could, first of all, theorize why Disney has these different policies, and secondly, take us into this other work on the theme park.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my theory behind the whole theme park difference, the difference between both of the drastic differences when it comes to Spanish at both of the parks is really situated within the political and cultural climate of the time periods in both in the two states,
Right.
California, like polar opposites, right? We have California and then we have Florida. And I mean, I unfortunately, and maybe this is foolish on my end, but I really was, so I moved to Florida in 2020. I moved to Florida in June of 2020, which it coincided. We have pandemic and presidential election happening at the same time. And I moved from Illinois, which, it's actually Illinois, aside from a really small time period when I lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico for my master's, living in Illinois for such a long period of time was the first time that I had lived in a non-red state for that long. And it was a very drastic, it was shocking, moving from Illinois to Florida. And I will say that I feel a little bit foolish because it is something that my husband warned me about. And he was like, all right, are you sure? Are we going to do this? Like, is this what we're in for? And I thought, yeah, it can't be that bad. But I think, and what I've figured out afterwards is that the thing that was the most shocking for me is that the Latinidades in the state of Florida, So I'm talking a very specific, I'm talking Latinidad, not anything outside of that, are very different from anything that I had previously experienced, especially growing up in Texas, where, you know, it's a majority Mexican, and I was in the majority, I will admit that. But I think for me, one of the things that was just the most striking, particularly, maybe it has to do in the area where I lived, and where I moved to in Florida, was seeing visually seeing all of the Latinos for Trump signs. And I also was doing some calls for the election. I was in charge of like some of the Spanish speakers, and it was just so striking to me how time and time again I would, you know, get hung up on for people that were just like, no, absolutely not. You're not going to change our minds. We are voting for Trump, and this is how it is. And I just thought, what? My life is turned upside down. I'm so confused. What is happening here? So there are very different. This is where I'm like, oh my goodness, how are, obviously, don't be so naive, Diana. Like, of course, there are, you know, there's Latinidades. They're so different. And this is the stuff that I research and that I look at in my work, and I've done it for years and years and years. But as a population, so I'm zooming into the Latinidad, the Latinxes, we are also vastly different, right? And what was happening within the trends that I was seeing within the Latinidades in Florida, of course, were present in other populations. And that is something that I think Disney wasn't experiencing that in California, right? The whole no Spanish here, you know, we are an English speaking country. This is, you know, the whole assimilationist narratives, you know, very, very much in line with all of that stuff. And I think that it's very specific to the two locations, the tourists that the parks attract from one coast versus the tourists that they attract from another coast. And a lot of it very specific to the local tourists too, because, you know, what I kept seeing in Florida is that a lot of international guests were the ones that really wanted to speak to the Spanish, to the princess in Spanish. I should say the cast member in Spanish. It was a lot of these international folks that would approach. And some of the, I mean, it was really awkward sometimes because some of these people didn't speak English, right? And you get this a lot at the parks where the characters are communicating, or attempting to communicate with people who don't speak the language. And that's common. But at least for me, it felt uncomfortable when it was, you know, supposedly part of the storyline of the princess, right? Supposedly part of what Disney worked so hard to promote, that she's Latina and that she eats buñuelos and calabaza and tacha and all of these things that the series promotes, that you see even prior to the television series coming out. You see it in the investor reports, you see it everywhere. And then you get to the Florida park and guests who speak in Spanish try to communicate with this cast member in that language. And she says, oh no, I do speak the language, but when we're here, I have to speak in English. I'm practicing my English. I'm in Cinderella's kingdom, which again, also just positions her as an outsider, right? She's in someone else's kingdom. She's in, and what I argue Cinderella's kingdom stands in for normative US mainstream culture, right? White culture. She's occupying the space as a visitor. It's temporary. And when she's in the space as a visitor, she is supposed to be working on assimilating, right? Her grandmother told her that she needs to practice her English. So that's what I think is happening there, which is, it's just so fascinating. And I think that I really do want to go do some of this follow-up work. I have been back to the parks, but not as a researcher. So not in that capacity. And I actually have not been back to Magic Kingdom, which is where the princess resides. And maybe that's been a strategic choice on my end, and I haven't really, like, subconsciously, but I do really want to go do some of that follow-up work to see, really, have the narrative shifted, have they not? Because one of my guesses was that once the series was over, which it's been over for a while, that they were going to face the princess out of the park, and she's still very much there. She is still occupying the same space that she was occupying when I went to conduct my research. And I would love to just go back and see what some of that looks like. But that takes us to our second question now about the Galaxy's Edge piece, which was it was a great experience. It was so fun to write with Professor Christopher Chavez, who's at the University of Oregon. He is a much bigger Star Wars fan than I am, so it was like really interesting to see us come together and because we wrote about the theme park space, but there was so much like back end work that went into that, and so many drafts that actually consisted of a lot more of the Star Wars narrative and a lot more of the shifts that we've seen in the different layers of Star Wars, which oof, he could probably speak a lot more to that than I can. But you know, Star Wars before Disney came in, Star Wars after, and even this like different type of version now that we've seen, that we continue to see within Star Wars, where Disney's owned Star Wars now for quite a while. And some of the trends and the shifts that we're seeing when it comes to the inclusion of non-white folks within the Star Wars universe. But one of the things that I do want to say really quickly about that project with Christopher Chavez is that it actually started off as a, and I think that I want to say too that I think it's cool to hear where like research projects started and how they started, just because of how much shifts. We originally wanted to do an analysis of theme park maps dating back to, gosh, I think we had gone back and found maps from like 1960s that we wanted to, not 1970, 1971. That the parks that we like, maps that we wanted to analyze, because we felt that there was so much to say and unearth about the significance of where certain themed lands are placed in the park, and it's particularly themed lands like the Tomorrowland and oh my goodness, I'm blanking now on the name, the one where you have all of the natives and the Mexicans and the bandidos and all of, you know, all of this stuff that is, not to sound cheesy and to bring in the title of my book, but all of the stuff that is like peripheral to the normative Frontierland. Sorry, the normative like Disney vision. So we were very interested in how the Anaheim Park had shifted, you know, these different spaces and what the meanings behind the locations in the lands, and you know how Frontierland was connected to you know the main castle area, and how you know Tomorrowland was connected to other spaces, and how Disney throughout the years had adapted and shifted a lot of these lands. So that's how the project actually started. We wanted to do an analysis of the Disney maps, and somehow along the way we gravitated towards Galaxy's Edge. It was brand I when we started writing the first draft of this article, actually the part, it hadn't opened yet. Galaxy's Edge was about to open. So when we took these trips, Galaxy's Edge was brand new, and we were very, our analysis is specific to the California park. So we just talk about the inclusion of Galaxy's Edge and the people the place and space that the non-white characters and actors occupy within these spaces. But one of the things that I think is also really fascinating is the location of Galaxy's Edge in Florida, which is drastically different because it's not even, it's in another park. So in California we have Galaxy's Edge, which is a part of you know the Disneyland sector, whereas here, or not here, I'm not even in Florida right now. In Florida, it's a part of another theme park. It's Hollywood Studios, and the placement of that in comparison to where we find it situated in California, very much as an extension of Frontierland, very much as a part of this like outsider narrative that we have seen, you know, time and time again from Disney when it comes to Latinidad, when it comes to representing Native America, like all of these different storylines that we see, particularly through Frontierland, sort of being extended onto Galaxy's Edge, placed in a sort of intergalactic fictive universe. That isn't necessarily what we see in Florida because of where Galaxy's Edge exists. and you know, the placement of it. Though what you see inside the themed land is very similar in terms of how they use the bodies of color and how it's very often something that, you know, Dr. Chavez and I argue that this is for the past 40-ish years, science fiction and speculative fiction have been spaces where people of color have been able to see themselves more, right? See more representations of themselves in these fictive space narratives. And a lot of that, we argue, has to do with the fact that it's less threatening, right? We put the Latinxes in outer space, and we don't have the same types of narratives that we would have if, you know, if it was a narrative that took place in Philadelphia, for example, as opposed to a galaxy far, far away. So that's something that we found, you know, we've been seeing a lot of throughout the years in terms of speculative fiction and the types of possibilities that these spaces allow for non-white bodies, and specific to our research for Latinxes. But seeing actually how it's translated into theme park spaces, I think for me is one of the most unique and exciting parts of this work, to see how the company is adapting and transforming and doing whatever they need to do in order to have these spaces exist in real time with real human beings interacting and occupying the space along tourists from all over the world. And, you know, I always say that there could be an amazing research project carried out by if it was like an actual cast member, because I can only give so many findings, right? I don't, you know, spend all my days at the park. Oh my goodness, that would be quite the mess. But I, you know, it's so dynamic, and there's so much that happens in these spaces that, you know, as a human being that has only gone a few times for research and has gone a couple of other times for entertainment, I can't really account for all of the exciting and dynamic things that are happening on the ground every single day. But, you know, it's like I said, and I'll just say it one last time, it is one of my favorite parts of the work that I do. And I think that it's really unique. And I hope that there's more projects like this that other people start carrying out or tackling, particularly with my modified situated ethnography. I've always hoped, like with that architectural flexibility, that other folks can take it and adapt it to other spaces, especially within like tourism studies, or even for folks that do work on like music festivals and environments and situations like that, that are very dynamic and ever changing. I really hope that the groundwork that I've laid out in that ethnographic chapter is useful to somebody that's doing similar work.
Prof, to conclude, I wonder if you might share with us anything else you'd like to add, anything we've missed, or something that we touched on where you want to say some more.
Yeah. I think in the conclusion of my work, and of the conclusion of my book, I make it very clear that I really like to highlight a balance in what I do. So while I do find all of these troubling things and these frustrating continuities over and over and over again, I find a lot of joy and excitement in what I see as well. And I talk about it in the book, where I say that the emotions that came out in me when I was watching Coco for the first time in theaters, and I heard the Disney song with the mariachis in the background, that is something that I never, as a child, experienced at the movie theaters. You know, mariachis, and I love mariachis. Mariachis always make me cry anyway. I'm just like a mess when I hear all of these different songs. And I want to balance that. I want to put forth a balance of the moments where I find joy and where I want to praise, while at the same time acknowledging, like, hey, there's all of these things that are inconsistent or continuous that hopefully we will continue to see revamps of or edits of. But I will echo one very important thing that my former advisor, Professor Angela Valdivia, will say time and time again, We cannot expect the revolution to come from Disney. We cannot expect the revolution to come from mainstream popular culture. And that is something that I also say that a lot to my child, who is now growing up to be a wonderful media critic. And sometimes I think, oh goodness, what have I done to this poor child? But I say, you know, you cannot expect, you cannot put all of that weight on this. And you can also not put all of that weight on one character. We have one supposed Latina princess coming from Disney. If Latinidad is so vast and diverse and beautiful and so, like, the heterogeneity is so thick and layered, we need more. We cannot expect this character or this narrative, this fictitious land, to do it all. And like I say at the very end of the book, if it's flexible and you keep messing with it and, you know, stretching it, it's going to snap. And you cannot expect this one narrative to bear that burden of representation for an entire community that is so vast and diverse and beautifully unique in many ways. You know, there's got to be more. So I'll leave it at that. Cannot expect the revolution to come from mainstream popular culture or from one narrative and one character.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful chatting with you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite. I really appreciate it.